Hey, we'll call to order the House Revenue Committee meeting and welcome everybody here today. Just a couple of agenda notes in case anyone's following through. House Bill 3029 will not be heard today. House Bill 3629, we will move that to the latter part of the agenda and we'll conduct that in a public hearing with the other remaining bills to begin toward the bottom of the first page, beginning with House Bill 3640. At that point, we will open the hearing on all of those bills together and then invite anyone who wants to speak on those bills. Those are primarily for, you know, what we call tap-tap hearings to get these bills heard before the last hearing deadline. We'll not be taking any action on those and don't even need any testimony on those bills today particularly, but if there's somebody here who has come to speak on one of those bills at the end of the agenda, we'll give you a chance to do that. But let's begin with House Bill 3382. We have this set for public hearing and possible work session. I have the sign-up sheet for that. And who's staffing that? 3382. Thank you. You look a lot like Dick Yates.
Man, I need your barber.
What's a session with our needed advice?
Okay, if you would please introduce us to House Bill 3382.
Okay, 3382. Let me read the staff measure summary that I prepared there. It deals with PERS assessments and apparently deals with a problem of a lot of local governmental units that have unfunded PERS liabilities. So it's not dealing with their annual ability to meet their annual assessments, but dealing with a problem which is built up over a period of time where they now have a substantial debt that they owe. And so the question is, how do they belly up to the bar more? How do they pay for those? And one way that they can do that is to, over a period of 20 or 30 years, is to pay higher PERS assessments to eventually fund that unfunded liability. This proposes an alternative, and what it does is to allow local governments to issue limited tax bonds or revenue bonds for the purposes of paying employer PERS assessments. The bonds are not subject to state or local limitations on indebtedness, but may not exceed 5% of the real market value of taxable property in the district. It allows local governments to pledge the full faith and credit of the governmental units, but no obligation is placed on the state or any state agency. Exempts issuance from procedures required for issuing municipal revenue bonds, allows for intergovernmental agreements so that, for example, school districts can operate as a unit rather than individually, and the purpose of that is, one, to reduce the cost of issuing the bonds. Collectively, they would be likely to get a much better bond rating. Allows local governments to establish a debt service trust for the purpose of paying principal and interest on the bonds so issued. Allows a local government that receives funds from a state agency to enter into funds diversion agreements for the purpose of paying principal and interest on the bonds so issued. Now, you have a dash one amendment, which is an attempt to sort of, EWEB apparently has a different sort of situation, and I'm not sure of the details of it, but anyway, it's different.
Well, they can tell us there's
something. Yeah, and this would allow them essentially to be included. And then when the people come forward, they'll have a dash three amendment, which replaces the bill, but folds the dash one amendment in.
So. Okay.
And I've just barely read this.
Okay. Well, it looks like everybody that's here has signed up with the dash threes, noted except for Mr. Smith, ready to testify on the dash threes too. Okay. Let's start. Nobody signed up in the first line, so I'm not sure what that means. So we'll start with our second person, Jim Green, And Ken Armstrong, why don't you come forward, too? And maybe you can start by telling us why you signed up second and not first.
We had hoped the treasurer would be signing up.
Would you like Mr. Smith to join you?
Would you like to, Chuck?
Sure.
Yeah, I see we're getting our dash three amendments now. Who wants to go first?
I'll go ahead.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Armstrong. I'm here today representing Seattle Northwest Securities. We've been working with the School Boards Association and the Treasurer's Office on this piece of legislation that we thoroughly endorse and believe is an extremely good bill. Let me briefly describe for you what the process is that is represented in this bill, and then turn it over to my colleagues to talk a little bit more about some of their perspectives on it, and then be available for any questions. Essentially, what we're trying to do here, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is to set up a mechanism for school districts and local governments to deal with their unfunded actuarial liability. This has primarily been driven by the school districts, and they've got an unfunded actuarial liability as of December of 2000, of just under $700 million. That's a real problem, and we've been trying to problem solve a way to help them get out from under that. The solution that we've come up with is in the form of House Bill 3382, which allows a couple of things to happen. It allows school districts and others to join together, either individually or to join together as an intergovernmental agreement, and to pool themselves to issue bonds to cover their unfunded actuarial liability. This is going to have the result, of course, of reducing the cost of covering their UAL. The hallmark of this piece of legislation, and the reason I think it's so innovative and a good approach, is that it allows the state to take the money that it would otherwise be sending directly to the school district as part of the school funds, and right off the top, for those that are participating in this program, send the money directly to a trustee to cover the debt service.
When you say off the top, you mean off the funding formula distribution?
Correct. That's correct, Mr. Chair. And so what that enables us to do, according to the rating agencies, is effectively get a much better rate by the state's involvement, sort of as a trustee, yet without obligating the state to play the role as the full faith and credit coverer of the debt service. So the state does not obligate itself, but it takes the dollars that would otherwise be sending to the districts off the top, sending it to cover the debt service, and we're able to achieve a savings on the $700 million in unfunded actuarial liability for schools of about $75 million. So it's an obligation that is already out there for the school districts, and it gives them the ability to realize some savings by simply bonding it. That's essentially what this bill does. There were a couple of technical changes that we wanted to make in this bill, and those are reflected in the dash threes, and then, of course, with EWEB and a couple of others, some amendments are folded into this that bring you the dash threes. We thoroughly endorse those, and with that, I turn it over to my colleagues.
If I could just ask, these bonds, then, are these bonds ultimately backed by the property tax base in the district?
By the districts.
But the mechanics of the payment are such that for those participating districts, the money is actually comes off the top of the distribution from the school fund formula.
That's correct. I mean, what would ordinarily take place is the money that the districts are receiving from the state, they would go ahead and put that aside to cover their UAL. This allows that same money to be funneled to a trustee that's going to end up paying the debt service. But it is the districts that continue to be on the hook and are providing the security for the debt.
So are property taxes affected or not affected by this?
Well, these are limited tax bonds and also revenue bonds, so it would be existing revenue streams. So it's the full faith and credit of the local jurisdiction. So yes, it would be that, but it would not allow you to set up additional taxing mechanisms to cover the bonds.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Who's next?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green, representing the Oregon School Boards Association, and what I might add to what Mr. Armstrong has indicated to you is, and I do apologize for the lateness of the Dash 3s getting to you. We were waiting for those to get out of council, and as soon as we had them, we were running around circulating them to folks. But Mr. Armstrong did indicate we do have in our school district a very large unfunded actuary liability in PERS, in excess of $680 million. The idea behind this, currently that amount of unfunded liability is being financed by the districts with PERS. They have all entered into agreements to pay this back at 8% over 27 years, which has driven up some of their contribution rates to PERS, their employer contribution rates. Right now, the bond market is in the low sevens. As Mr. Armstrong indicated, if we're able to get school districts to pool together and do this, we do realize a savings of about $75 million, which school districts can use to provide services to boys and girls as opposed to pay their unfunded actuarial liability with PERS. The idea is to get us current with PERS, and then with the changes that the PERS board has done with regard to employer accounts matching what employee accounts do, we don't anticipate the unfunded actuarial liability growing again like it has due to the circumstances that we've had in the last 4 to 5 years. And we are in total support of the Dash 3s. Again, as Mr. Armstrong indicated, we had the Dash 3s drafted to craft in the eWebs concerns, a City of Springfield issue, and the Dash 3s do subsume the Dash 1s, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Green? No? Okay, Mr. Smith. Oh, I'm sorry.
Rick? Just as a technical question, I guess, to make sure that I understand at least, the money for the purpose of payment of debt service is not coming out of the state school fund before determination of the individual district grants, but it comes out of the money the state would otherwise pay to an individual district.
Mr. Chairman, staff, that's correct. And remember, this is voluntary on the part of school districts. This would not mandate anything that a school district or a school district board did not want to do. What would happen is the mechanics, and we have the ability currently to pool together to issue bonds. What this gives us is the ability to say those monies that come from you to the Department of Education in the form of the state school fund to allow a portion of those funds after divvied up through the formula to be paid to a trustee to pay that debt service. And that effectually, as Mr. Armstrong said, effectually would give us a state rate almost. The state rate right now, I believe, is AA+. And we have school districts that have a hard time getting a bond rating. What we've heard from the rating agencies is you'd probably come in at around a AA-, which would be better than what most school districts could have.
Now, school districts are financing their PERS liability out of their general fund now, aren't they?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. They're paying for that right now, and through the runs that we've seen that Seattle Northwest has provided us and some other entities, it could, depending on what the bond market is at when they enter in, right now it's in the low sevens, it has the actual savings of about $75 million.
So it would be a fair analogy to say this is like paying off one high credit card rate debt by using a lower credit card rate, basically.
Or a home equity loan.
That's right. Yeah. You're paying it out.
We already used the credit card.
Mr. Chairman, that would be correct. The one thing I would also say about these are not tax exempt bonds.
Right.
These are taxable at the federal level.
Okay,
Mr. Chair. So the $75 million saving, I missed some of the last exchange, maybe you're restating this, but a $75 million saving is over how long? Is that per year, or is that the life of these?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, I'm remembering back to the conversations we had early on with regard to this, and that would be the savings that school districts would realize over the time of paying back the debt service, minus that 27-year payback to PERS at 8%. So it's that savings in there over that time.
Over the period of time.
Correct.
We're not dealing with major yearly savings. We're not going to be able to go home and say we saved our school district $1 million.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, that would depend on which school districts enter this. If you have all 198 school districts entered this idea and the contribution rate would drop for school districts, you could, depending on those savings and the drop in that contribution rate, could be considerable savings for school districts.
So our district ought to be able to tell us, look at this bill and tell us what they're going to save in their next or whenever this would take effect, they should be able to tell us how much they would save as a result of this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, again, that's going to depend on what the bond market's going to bear at that time.
At that time. So you still have to go out and mechanically do this, yeah. Okay, great.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chuck Smith, and I'm Director of Debt Management at the Oregon State Treasury. These two gentlemen that spoke previously have pretty well outlined this bill. Once again, here's an opportunity for local governments to pool resources and to lower their costs and achieve economies of scale, and I think that's one of the interesting things about this transaction or this proposed transaction. Two of our largest municipalities have already issued pension bonds, the City of Portland and Multnomah County. They've done this. They've had the sort of wherewithal to undertake that individually, but there's a lot of other folks out there, a lot of school districts, as well as other districts, that this bill would provide a great advantage to those folks to pool and take advantage of larger issuance, lower cost, reduce their costs. It's important that I think local governments be given the option to bond for this unfunded pension liability. Many of these folks really don't have the opportunity to meet the liability and otherwise. I'd be happy to answer any questions or try to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions for Mr. Smith or any of the other two on the panel now? All right, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Maria Tiltner and Nancy Brewer. Kathy Bloom, why don't we have you come on up, too? We'll just fill up the table.
Chair Setterly and members of the committee, my name is Maria Keltner. I'm a policy advocate for the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties. And you are being handed a short summation, and attached to that is a list showing the counties, cities, and local governments and the amount of their unfunded actuarial liability as of the December 31st, 1999 PERS valuation. These are the figures we're looking at in terms of bonding for. Both AOC and LOC support House Bill 3382, the -3 amendments, and we urge your support.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Kathy Bloom, and I represent Eugene Water and Electric Board. I'm here today to ask you for some changes to House Bill 3382.
As reflected in the -3s?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Our -1 amendment is exactly what we want in -3 in section.
Okay, we have the -3s in front of us that replace the bill. You scared me.
Sorry.
Okay.
So basically what the additional language relates to is the issue Eugene Water and Electric Board has, which is we have several retirement plans in addition to our retirement plan with PERS. And the total unfunded actual liability of those plans is about $3.8 million. And the additional language in this bill would allow us to issue bonds also for those actual liabilities. So what we would like to do is issue bonds for our PERS liability, which is $55 million, along with these others, and wrap that into one bond issue.
And I guess I'll just ask for the record, your testimony, too, was as to the -3s with the EWEB amendments in there.
Representative Setterly, that's correct.
And unless Jim Green or Ken Armstrong or Chuck Smith stand up and speak now, my understanding is that their testimony, too, encompassed the -3 amendments with the EWEB. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Setterly and committee. My name is Nancy Brewer, and I'm the finance director for the City of Corvallis. I'm also the chair of the League of Oregon Cities PERS Task Force, and we've been working for quite some time to get this bill introduced and get the amendments that are represented in -3. Although the City of Corvallis could issue pension obligation bonds, and we're exploring that on our own, there are a number of cities and counties which, because of the way they were formed or what's in their charter, are not currently able to issue pension bonds to deal with their unfunded liabilities. And this bill would make that a possibility for all of the local governments in the state. You were correct. This is kind of like refinancing your home mortgage. And when you're given the opportunity to refinance a substantial debt at a lower rate, smart financial management says take the opportunity and take care of your long-term finances. This would go a long ways towards addressing that. So we do support the Dash 3 amendments and encourage the approval of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Cross.
Thank you. I'm not sure who to address this question to, but this is the handout from ALC and LOC on the list of different counties, and I was just scanning down and noticing that Benton has a 42% unfunded percent of payroll, Lane County 67%, Washington 26%. If this type of an arrangement wasn't available, what's going to happen to these counties with such a large proportion?
When what has happened, and I'll speak for the city of Corvallis, we have a $12.5 million unfunded liability, which represents 71% of our annual payroll. What has happened with PERS is they have amortized that over the next 27 years, and we are paying about 4.25 percentage points of payroll annually to pay that debt off. Mm-hmm. The ability to issue a pension obligation bond and the debt that we would pay for that would allow us to lower our annual payments from about $900,000 to about $850,000 in kind of a worst-case high interest rate scenario. So it results in substantial cost savings. We would no longer pay that money to PERS. We would pay it to the bondholders, and that's how the trade-off works.
You'd pay the $850 to the bondholders.
That's correct. And, we would pay
then to go into your general fund for services, whatever else you need to use.
That's correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what I want to know from the county is if we're going to get credit for putting...
No.
No, probably not. Okay.
Don't even go.
Okay. Anybody else? Thanks very much. And does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3382? It's my intention to go ahead and close the public hearing and go to work session on this. I think this is a dynamite idea, a way to pay a debt that's already owing, but do it in such a way that we save some money to local governments and school districts. So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3382 and open a work session. We have the Dash 3 amendments before us. Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3382.
Okay. Representative Witt moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3382. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? So ordered. Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3382 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Witt moves House Bill 3382 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Representative Kefouri, did you want to say anything?
I think this is a good bill, and I'll be voting yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Please call the roll.
Hughes.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Taft.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 3382, as amended, goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I want to thank you for bringing the bill forward. We need a carrier. Anybody want to volunteer to take questions about bonds and PERS? Representative Beck? Okay.
All right.
not denying fast enough is kind of like admitting.
This is okay now.
I haven't done anything for a while.
Okay. Let's go to... is Representative Butler coming in on 2555? Did he indicate that he wanted to?
He was here.
He was here?
He left.
Oh, I missed him. Okay, please do. Yeah. Where is he, Joan? Okay. Let's be in recess for just a couple of minutes rather than start the other.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do you know? Well, four. Okay, we'll be back in session. And what I will do then is apologize for the delay, but since Representative Butler isn't as handy as I thought he was, let's go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2162 and ask Dick to give us the background on what we have and how we got here.
2162, Mr. Chair, is... the original bill dealt with the sunset on funding of administrative costs for forestry for the reforestation tax credit in the WOSTOP program. That remains in the bill under the Dash 2 amendments, which is what we're really looking at. The Dash 2 amendments are then added to the bill, so we'll have both pieces in it. Now, the Dash 2 are sort of a completion of the work the committee did earlier in 35-37, which was to finish up the changes that began in 99 with respect to timber taxation for large owners. And what this does is to treat the small ownerships. And what it does is to delete the property tax, the optional property tax programs for forest lands and small ownerships less than 5,000 acres beginning 2003-2004. So it disqualifies forest land in the Western Oregon Small Tract Option Program. This will take all that forest land that's currently there and disqualify it and then requalify it as forest land. So it will remain specially assessed but as forest land rather than under the small tract option. By deleting these optional programs, forest land in small ownerships is exempt from the Eastern and Western Oregon privilege taxes, and forest land in the small tract option continues to be exempt. It's currently exempt, and that exemption would continue. It requires the Department of Forestry to convene a working group of six members from specified interest groups to review the state tax policy affecting forest land held in common ownerships of less than 5,000 acres. It specifies that the areas that must be considered in the review appropriates $50,000 in general fund revenue to the Department of Forestry for these working groups and then reimburses the general fund out of the timber tax account, which is the same account that's already funding those forestry expenses. And it eliminates the sunset from funding of Department of Forestry's administrative expense in connection with the reforestation tax credit and the Western Oregon small tract option. Now, that's the original bill. You have a dash one amendments, which rather than eliminating that sunset, move it out 2 years.
Okay. All right.
You have a revenue impact statement there, as well as a staff measure summary.
With the appropriation, does this have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
It does.
It does, okay. Then let's bring up Ray Craig and Wally Rutledge.
Yes.
Madam Director, do you want to come up too? I'm hoping to hear from you.
Chair, I'm impersonating Wally Rutledge.
Okay. Well, you're not doing a very good job, but we're glad to see you. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ray Craig. I'm Assistant State Forester with the Department of Forestry, and with me is Elizabeth Harshenko, the Director of the Department of Revenue. And we're here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2162. We came before the committee once before on this bill and asked to have the sunset removed, and for a variety of reasons, the committee moved to sunset the program in 2 years, and so we're here to support that amendment, the dash one amendments. Then the dash two amendments, as Dick explained, deal with another issue. House Bill 3575 from the 1999 legislature changed the way forest lands are taxed and established a working group to work through some details. And when the work group, when it was all said and done, there was a feeling that the taxing issues for the family forest landowners weren't adequately addressed. And so the Department of Revenue, the Governor's Office, and the Department of Forestry negotiated out some language together, and that language before you then is the dash two amendment. So the Forestry Department does support that. The amendments do basically six things. They direct the Department of Forestry to convene a working group to review state tax policies that affect the family forest landowner. Spells out four principles that should be considered by the work group. Establishes the representatives of the work group. Places all forest land without regard to ownership size into one tax program beginning in July 1, 2003. It appropriates $50,000 for the Department of Forestry to basically get this done, and that money will be used primarily for facilitation-type work. And then it directs the working group to report to the next legislature concerning tax policies for the family forest landowners, including any recommendations for changes in policy, and the department supports these amendments. So with that, the Forestry Department does support the bill with the dash one and the dash two amendments. And Elizabeth, do you want to say anything at this point?
If I may, I'm sorry, Representative Butler has just arrived, and as we called him down, I think away from the committee, come in, if I may recess the hearing on House Bill 2162 with apologies, and let's change teams here and bring up Ed Waters, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2555, and welcome, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Chair Shirley, members of the committee. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60.
Well, we know who you are.
Oh, thank you. would you send a note to my wife?
He was sighted in the building.
Yes. She would appreciate knowing that, I'm sure. Members of the committee, today I think is a particularly poignant day to bring in a bill that talks about termination of farming activities and being able to sell farming assets, capital assets used in the trader business of farming and ranching. Frequently, over the last 25 years of practice as a certified public accountant in the state of Oregon, I have seen widows or usually a widow and sometimes a widower who's attempting to divest themselves of their farming operation. And under Oregon's capital gains tax rate, Oregon's tax rate as it presently stands, there's no benefit in the form of a reduced capital gain over ordinary income. And you have a fiscal impact, which indicates that there could be as much as a fiscal impact of no more than $100,000 in 2001, 2003, and perhaps $200,000 in the next biennium. Now, I very seldom let a fiscal impact statement like that bother me, except that I always ask about it. And of course, in order to do this, you've got to have a gain. And certainly we understand that that gain would be that come about as a result of the sale of farm assets at a profit, and that that profit was it would assume that they would do something with that profit which would be enjoyable to the family. However, many times those profits are used to pay off other obligations and debts. It's like the fellow that won the $4 million lottery that's paid out in $200,000 a year in Eastern Oregon. I asked him what he was going to do. He said he was going to farm until it was all gone. That's 20 years, and he's in year 17 now of 20, and every year he farms until it's all gone, and sometimes even borrows against the next year. So basically this is where we're at today in the tough farm economy, is that many times these after-tax profits are used to pay the seed bill, the feed bill, the fertilizer bill, the tractor company, and the repair shop, and the tire store. And not necessarily in that order, Representative Brown, but in that process, then that's that much less as bad debt losses that these other businesses would be having to write off that are picked up as profits and are eventually taxable by the state of Oregon. So this bill would reduce the capital gains tax rate on personal and corporate tax rates alike to 5% of the net capital gains derived from the liquidation of assets used in a farming business. The bill is fairly specific as to what happens as what it means to divest yourself of a farming or ranching business and to sell all of those assets, and it also breaks it down as between the section 1231 assets and 1245 assets, and Director Archenko will be coming on next, and she can tell you what all of those are. Mm-hmm. So if you have questions, I'd be delighted to answer them or attempt to.
Questions for Representative Butler.
Chairman?
Representative Hess.
Devil's advocate, Representative. Philosophically speaking, the dot-com business has been particularly tough in Washington County. Now, would you support a measure that have built in all these kinds of issues for people in that business?
Representative Hass, Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, this is an extremely limited bill, and had we had farms that were making millions and hundreds of millions of dollars out of each and making farmers virtually overnight billionaires, other than the Jed Klamkin family from wherever he was shooting rabbits at, if we had that kind of situation, then I don't think we would see the distressed situation that we have in the state of Oregon. And if we were worried about food, fiber, and the other sources of the things that we live on a daily basis from the dot-com folks, then maybe that would create a little bit different program. But I wouldn't advocate this for anyone that really didn't absolutely need it. And again, if the dot-comers were just paying off their bills, that would be a different situation. Mm-hmm. Normally, we'll see them living in a little bit better circumstances than what these farmers, after they sell out and dispose of everything, will end up in. Usually, they will end up in their own home, close to or in town, usually in town. Very modest situation, very modest living. Usually, Social Security wages or Social Security is not enough to sustain them. And usually one or two of the family, if it's still an older couple, will have a different kind of a pension, because usually when we see farmers in most of the rural situations, the second spouse normally has to have a second job. So sometimes we'll have a second source of a pension income in addition to a very modest $400 to $500 a month Social Security, and then some other pension income that would come in just enough to sustain these folks. So we're not dealing with large fortunes in any way, shape, or form.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hess.
Well, whether it's, and I didn't mean to single out dot-coms or farmers, but there's all kinds of different issues, vocations, professions. Washington County has the biggest food bank pass-outs than any county per capita in the state. And a lot of people don't realize there's still a lot of poverty in the suburbs. And so my point is that if we're going to do this, why limit it just to farmers? Why not do it to everyone? Or why not? How would you respond if I brought to you a bill that had limited privilege to a select occupation or profession?
I'd vote yes, Mr. Chair.
He's good.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, I missed your point. If you're talking about the farms if you're talking about the farmlands and farms in the metropolitan areas, those folks selling and liquidating their farms, and in fact, there's a fairly narrow definition of farming activity and reporting on farm. And as a matter of fact, the definition is so narrow that if they haven't been farming it or have been demonstrating losses, technically they can be pitched out as hobby losses and wouldn't have been shown on a farm schedule typically immediately for a number of years immediately before the disposition of that property. And normally, then at that particular point, the question arises, was that property that was sold in Washington County or wherever, was it in fact being used as a farm? Because if it was held as an investment as opposed to farmland at that point, then it changes the nature of it, and it wouldn't be farmland. But if your question is, would a capital gains tax for everyone within the state of Oregon at a reduced rate from the 9% be a more fair way to tax investment gains on capital property, I would say yes, and I would say yes unequivocally, and the reason for that is that these are gains typically that we see as a result of inflation. Now, I didn't print up any money last year, and I'm certain that the Department of Treasury would like to know if I had. Those folks that have the ability to print up money are some of the folks that help us with the inflation factor in this country. And it's that inflation factor, it's government and certain other sectors of industry that can push inflation. And I wish that I could tell you that farmers were enjoying some of that inflation. However, with wheat and grain and many of the other kinds of prices that we're experiencing today, which are actually lower than Dust Bowl Depression days in many cases, my family lost their farms. My grandfather lost his farms and his businesses and eventually his life in the depressions of the mid and late 20s. And the prices which we're experiencing today as my father tries to sell grain off of our family farm are about the same prices as he was getting back in those days. And these are travesties, but the situation is that we pay so much more for the kinds of things that we're buying today other than food, and this is a sector which certainly deserves to be recognized and not be taxed for the inflation on that which they have no ability to really control, whereas on my .com stock I can buy and sell it fairly evenly on the market most times.
Mr. Chair, just in close, just
sure.
Briefly, Representative, I plan to vote yes on this. My only point was there are a lot of people that are struggling, not just farmers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hass, I recognize that and appreciate it. And again, I'd like to say, to the extent that they do, I would say let's reduce the rate across the board. But this addresses a portion of my district. I don't have many .coms. This addresses a portion of my district and the rural people throughout the state of Oregon that are having some real serious needs right now. And I appreciate your yes vote.
Don Schellenberg.
Mr. Chairman, Don Schellenberg, Associate Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I just want to second what Representative Butler has so ably stated. And Representative Haas, I believe, was in the Labor Committee the other day, is that correct, when I testified on a bill regarding the CPI. And it would, how the CPI, everything being tied to Consumer Price Index, has really caused us a big problem in agriculture. If we could only get the CPI, get our commodity prices tied to the CPI, then we might be in a good position to be able to do a lot of things that we're being asked to do. I was just downstairs at noon today, and maybe some of you were there too. Farm Labor Housing, CASA put on a program down there, and Oregon Department of Agriculture Director Phil Ward was making a presentation there. And what I understood him to say, and he didn't connect the two, but I did in my mind, he indicated that the farm gate income in the last year was about $3.4 billion. Then he went on to say that the prices that farmers paid for the inputs used to produce that income was about $3.4 billion. And he didn't make the connection, but I certainly did. And that's about where agriculture is. Everything we get, we spend. And there's not much left to live on. So just to make that point and support House Bill 2555. And also, you did mention about, and Representative Haas, about a broader extension of the capital gains tax. And, of course, you're probably aware there is a Senate bill on the Senate side that I hope will be coming over here that will phase in a capital gains provision for everyone. And so we would not want this to detract from that, obviously, but maybe in and not in lieu of that either. But we do support the concept. Thank you.
Well, my inclination with the committee's indulgence would be to go ahead and move this out today, and then assuming it gets across the floor to the Senate, where it'll be held pending rebalance with everything else, and then also pending to see whatever happens on the other bill. But at least this one will be in a position to move forward before sine die, if that's what we'll do. That's what we'll do.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
Oh, we have Representative Butler here. In the context of this discussion, it raises so many just macro issues. You know, who are we going to help? But to me, it is passing something like this. I would encourage Representative Butler, I don't know what your position is on this, but I would hope that would also give you time to reflect about how we address issues like the kicker debate, which if we decide to pay back the federal retirees and reserve a little more flexibility in the budget, gives us more flexibility to helping some of the most needy people in our society. And I guess I do see these kinds of issues as we wind down the session here starting to be related, not bill trade-offs, but just philosophically. I mean, as I sit here not representing a lot of farmers, but I do represent a lot of struggling folks, and I'm not asking you for your position on the kicker today, but I just, I just...
Because everybody in the room is listening.
Yeah, right. Anyway, I think that it does raise this issue for all of us, that if we're going to start recognizing needs of people in rural communities, we also have to recognize the needs of unfortunate people all over the state, and we are going to need as much flexibility as we can in this budget discussion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, thank you very much, and I would make this comment in that regard. I was very fortunate in the opportunity that I had in my first session to be able to chair general government, and if you'll recall, in the last session in the general government, we did pass a payment of the retirees, federal retirees, to be paid in full last session, and that passed through both houses in this bicameral legislature, and it was vetoed.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2555? All right, then let me close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 2555.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I move House Bill 2555 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Witt moves House Bill 2555 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Say. Aye.
Yeah.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Pat.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 2555 goes to the 2555. Sorry, goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. And Representative Butler, you can have another one of our revenue bills. Okay. Let's go back then and fight Director Harchenko back, and we will reopen the hearing on House Bill 2162. I think we were just finished Mr. Craig's overview from forestry, and you were going to tell us about it from revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. As you recall, I came before the committee a few weeks back and talked to you about House Bill 3537, which was one of the work products of the interim progeny of House Bill 3575 from the 1999 legislative session. In 3575, a work group was created to try to address some of the concerns that the owners of smaller parcels of forest land had about changes in the process for the taxation of forest land in Oregon. And the charge to that group was relatively narrow. It was to develop an alternative system for the deferral of the payment of property taxes. My understanding is that as the group met during the interim this time and talked, they realized that they wanted to try to explore a much broader base of issues about the treatment of smaller parcels of farmland than that charge allowed, and that they have asked for an extension.
Sorry, farmland or forest land?
Excuse me, forest. I was listening to the prior conversation. Forest land. And so they would like to be able to have this interim to do that work. And forestry has graciously agreed to sponsor a new group and conduct those discussions. The Department of Revenue is trying to move forward as best we can with implementation of this new system that begins in the 2003 to 2004 tax year. And obviously, anyone who's familiar with the way that the legislative process works, that if the group comes back next session with legislation that affects the taxation of forest land, that it cannot have an emergency clause on it. And depending upon how long the legislative session lasts, the effective date of legislation in the 03 session could very well be past the date that the assessors have to turn the tax roll to the tax collectors. This concern's been raised by the small owners. It's a very legitimate concern because the way that the Dash 2 amendments are drafted, there really is no safety net if nothing is done. What I have done is give my assurance to the small owners group that if they are able to develop a proposal early during the interim, get that cleared at least with the interim committee, and it looks like something that will move forward expeditiously through the session, and we can work with them, that if the legislature chooses to make it applicable to the 2003-2004 tax year, we will do everything we can to make that happen. A lot will depend on the structure of whatever that recommendation looks like. But if it does come early on, and we will be working in a supporting role with forestry, with the group, we will do everything we can to make it work for 03-04. So I just wanted to reassure the committee that we are not trying to create a roadblock for further development of appropriate policy. We have a financial problem, and that is we've already given up in our 01-03 budget the positions that are necessary to administer the privilege tax and the alternative system that the small owners are currently using, effective with the January 1 of 2003. And so if something needed to change, we would need to go back and adjust our budget. But otherwise, I just wanted to be on the record that we've made a commitment to work with them and to try to make whatever they come up with work if we're able to get it.
And you can accommodate the process that's anticipated in the Dash 2s?
Yes.
Within your budget?
Yes. Our budget anticipates what the Dash 2s reflect.
Okay.
If there's a change to them, we would need to change our budget.
Okay. Any questions for these two? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Harshenko, do you have the authority now through the rulemaking process to address this issue if the legislature doesn't in 2003?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, if the legislature does nothing in 2003, the Dash 2 amendments effectively place all forest land under the program that the industrial owners will be under. So that, and our budget has been set up on the expectation that everybody's going to be under that program. So if there's something different that comes along, We do have fairly broad rulemaking authority. We've had to do these kinds of things before. When Measure 5 was passed, when Measure 50 was passed, the legislature was considering legislation and how things were going to be implemented. We were tracking along with that and trying to anticipate, and we've had the legislature do this kind of thing before, where it has said, here's a law change. It's not legally enforceable until in the fall, but we want it to apply to this tax period. And we've done what we could to make sure that that worked. So I think we've got the resources in place and the partnerships in place that as long as the decisions are made fairly early and they're fairly clear what they're going to be, that we should be able to make this seamless.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. So in other words, it will be necessary for the legislature to do something in 2003. And if it doesn't, then the smaller forest landowners would fall under the industrial forest owners statutes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wood, that is correct.
Okay.
That's the proverbial hammer, I suppose, over the whole process. Okay, let's hear from the small forest land and Farm Bureau, Christina McNitt and Gene William Wilkinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Actually, Christina McNitt with Small Woodlands and Gene Wilkinson with
Farm
Bureau.
What did I say?
Farm Bureau. That's okay. 1997, I was Farm Bureau, so.
That's true.
Fondly recalled.
That's what I was thinking.
Right.
Oh, you're right.
I have testified previously before this committee in support of House Bill 2162, which continues to appropriate funds to the Department of Forestry for their administration of WOSTOT, which is a tax program for small woodland owners, and for the reforestation tax credit. And we continue to support 2162. In addition, we have the Dash 2 amendments, which have been explained in detail. I did have some concerns on the part of OSWA. I didn't understand that if you, in effect, repeal current programs that are, exist for the small owner, and you repeal that on July 1st of 2003, and whatever we come up with through this next work group and pass in the 2003 session would not become effective until most likely October of 2003. I was concerned, and frankly still share some concern, but feel much better with Director Harchenko's testimony, that there's a possibility if we don't get rules written, I foresaw the small landowners, and there's about 45,000 of them across the state, dumped into the 100% ad valorem program of the corporate landowners, and then having to transition to a different program the following year, which in the long term, I don't see how that saves money for either the Department of Revenue or the Department of Forestry, and would be extremely confusing for the small woodland owners. The Department of Forestry has a committee called the Family Forest Land Committee. They had a symposium in Corvallis, and one of the main issues that seemed to be riddled through all of their discussion items with respect to forest practices, with respect to certification, a wide variety of issues, was a continuing theme of taxation. And part of the difficulty of taxation is that it changes and evolves faster than these woodland owners are able to absorb. In many cases, they might only conduct two operations in their lifetime. And so it's just, it's not something they deal with annually like the industrial forest landowners do. I know this committee is sympathetic to that, and we're very supportive of the Dash 2 amendments, and I would like to commend the Department of Forestry and the Department of Revenue for their leadership in helping us come up with this two-year extension. And frankly, to Link Cannon, too, who has gone through a lot of pain and suffering this last interim for really no reason. The industrial owners, other than if we make their life complicated, couldn't care less about what we come up with, and he put in a lot of time, and it was not an easy process for any of us. But with a contribution of the Department of Revenue and their testimony about the fact that they apparently can write rules on some legislation that wouldn't yet exist, so that it would be able, as Ms. Harchenko said, we could push the go button in October as soon as we're done. I feel comfortable with that. Again, we're not looking for a safety net per se. That's part of the bargain. OSWA stepped to the table and said that we were going to come up with an alternative tax program. Existing programs are going to go away. I just don't want this process to somehow miss 1 year and pop those landowners onto a different program. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Wilkinson.
Thank you,
Chairman Shetterly, members of the committee. I'm Jean Underhill Wilkinson with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Normally, I'm before these committees dealing with commodity bills and transportation bills, but we do have forest landowners who are members of the Farm Bureau, and we have been watching this issue closely. We've been working through the Small Woodlands Association, and they've been taking the lead on this issue, and it sounds like you are really up to speed on what's going on here, but I did want to just share our views. We understand and have been observing this this new taxation program that will be finally phased in 2003, where forest landowners, whether they're, as it exists, whether they're small or large, will be paying 100% of the assessed value. This is, of course, appealing to some small woodland owners, but not appealing to others. Probably not only because these small woodland owners don't deal with these taxes on an annual basis, but we have a lot of diverse types of membership. Some of our forest landowners are more intense timber managers, where they rotate with cutting and thinning their timber and have incomes from that timberland every few years, whereas also so we deal with a lot of small woodland owners who want to just leave their lands idle and want to, for conservation purposes or for aesthetic purposes, or just saving their property and that timber and letting it grow to hand it down to their heirs. Whatever the reason is, they don't really harvest that timber except on a 70-year, 80-year basis. So there is diverse membership in there, and so different needs for different types of taxes. And that's really the problem that we've been dealing with here, in my view. Some tax programs are going to be appealing to some small woodland owners and not work at all for other small woodland owners. We were disappointed that this last interim group was not able to come up with a tax program that was going to appeal to enough of the small woodland owner community. But we think with this new plan that Department of Revenue has come up with, Department of Forestry has worked on it as well, and the Small Woodlands Association, we think that this the dynamics are in place with the small woodland owners and everyone else, that we can come up with this plan, come up this interim with a program that will work, and we're hoping that it can be pulled together such that it can apply in the 2003 tax year, and we won't be dealing with mass confusion by forcing these small woodland owners into temporarily one program, then pulling them back to another option. So again, we appreciate the efforts by everyone, and we look forward to participating in this new program. So we support the Dash 2 amendments. Thank you.
I would say ideally, of course, we would have had this fixed in the last interim and passed the legislation this session to put in place whatever that new program is. But short of that, I think this is the best plan B that there is in the building right now. And I guess I would extend the same thanks and commendation to the Department of Forestry and Department of Revenue, but also to Farm Bureau and OSWA for being able to pull back together and at least get this plan B put together before the end of the session. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these witnesses? This goes away from me. Okay. Does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2162? Okay, I'll close public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2162. We have the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Representative Witt, is that yours?
Yes. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I will move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2162.
Representative Witt moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2162. Is there any discussion on the Dash 1s? Any objection? They're in.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2162.
Representative Witt moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2162. Is there any discussion on that motion? Any objection? So ordered.
These go to Ways and Means, Mr. Chairman.
Dick, you want to clarify, there was not a subsequent on the bill, but with the fiscal impact and the Dash 2s, it does go to Ways and Means. Is that right?
I think that would be appropriate.
Okay. And it also ties in with the department's budget, is it? Okay. As everyone seems to agree that that's the case. Okay.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2162 as amended to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
With a due pass?
The due pass recommendation.
Representative Witt moves House Bill 2162 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and with the referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on that motion? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Staff.
Aye.
Day.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye. You messed me up, huh? Me.
Brown.
Aye.
Staff.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
Leah.
Aye.
Clark.
Aye. House Bill 2162 goes to the floor as amended with a referral to Ways and Means. Thank you very much. I think that takes care of the work sessions we had today. Now, if everyone will...
The one we had at the end.
Oh, yeah. We are... Oh, that's right. That's right. We are... It's after 2 o'clock. No, don't leave yet. Don't leave.
Be right back.
Okay. All right. 3977, we just need to move that to Ways and Means.
39. Okay. After 2 o'clock.
Yeah. You want to tell us, we open a work, public hearing on House Bill 3977. Dick, do you want to tell us why we need to send that to Ways and Means?
What the bill does is it extends the sunset on 911 emergency communications tax. If you remember, we dealt earlier in the session with House Bill 2098 and sent it down to Ways and Means. And as a result of the way the process works, I guess, it has become now 3977 and somewhat more extensive, and it's been sent back to this committee. We're dealing with the funding. It's here primarily because it is the extension of a tax, the 911 tax. In addition to, now, in the original 2098, that was an 8-year extension of the sunset. This is a 2-year extension of the sunset. In addition to doing that, it requires the Secretary of State to do performance audits on a sample of cities to determine compliance with the statutorily specified uses of 911 funds. Requires the Office of Emergency Management to develop a primary public safety answering point consolidation plan based on the audit findings that provides for a single PSAP, or primary answering point, per county. Requires the Office of Emergency Management to report to the next legislative assembly on what is the result of what its plan, consolidation plan, is and what the result of the audits were. Now, the bill appropriates $1,754,101 to the 911 subaccount to purchase communications equipment for the Central Communications and Consolidation Center, and then limits the distribution from the communications account to $56 million. And as part of that, the Office of Emergency Management has already has an expenditure limitation for $16.5 million already, which carries them through the point at which this tax is sunsetted. So they've added another $39.5 for the period, assuming the sunset is continued, which brings the total to $56 million. So that's the way that they're able to get the $56 million to be distributed. Now, the revenue estimate indicates that the money coming in will be larger than that. And any excess amount then goes into this new account, which is the establishes the primary public safety answering port consolidation incentive fund.
You're talking us into a quick referral.
There is one problem with the bill, and I suspect that that can be taken care of in Ways and Means. They put an effective date, if I can find the bill here.
Who took it from him?
You're killing me, Dick.
They put an effective date on the changes to Section 10 of the 1981 laws August 2002. Now, there is a technical change in the bill at the top of page 2, which has to do with how you identify whether a answering point is within the state or not. And they want that to take effect on August 1 of 2001. But also in that same section is the sunset on the tax. And that can't be delayed. So I've recommended that they simply, where the reference here is to the amendments to Section 10, they make that Section 10 sub 1. In which case it will only affect that. But I suspect that can be done in Ways and Means.
Okay. Does anybody, I see some of our 911 people here, anybody want to talk about this? satisfied with that overview and that it's appropriate to fix it down in Ways and Means. Okay? Well, with that explanation.
We got to go to work session.
I'm really happy to do this. close the public hearing on House Bill 3977 and open a work session. Representative Williams?
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to move this bill to the Ways and Means to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Oh, no, without recommendation, with subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Representative Williams moves House Bill 3977 to the floor without recommendation and that the bill be referred to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hess?
I like the part about the Division of Audits doing this. Performance audits. We had a bill to do this, Representative Leonard and I, to do this with school districts. Representative Butler killed it.
He's still going to be us on his bill today.
That's what I'm saying.
What a nice guy.
It's time to become a SOB around here, Mark.
What's that?
Good pass.
Okay. then please call the roll. Excuse.
Brown. Aye.
In your category.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Rhea.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Kapori.
Aye.
Chair Satterley.
Aye. House Bill 3977 goes to the floor without recommendation and with referral to Ways and Means Committee. All right, thank you. Now, what I'm going to do, and Representative Williams, I guess they do things differently in the Revenue Committee than they do in Judiciary, Paul tells me. We are going to open a public hearing on all of these bills at once, and then we'll just invite people to come up and talk to us all at the same time. We'll just go down the list and take anybody who's here who wants to testify. What I'll do in the interest of time is simply read the bill number and then the summary on the agenda. Then when we get all the bills, the hearing open on all the bills, we'll just see if anybody wants to talk to us about any of them, and then we will be done. So, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3640, which provides personal income tax credit for contributions made to shelters for homeless persons, food kitchens, food banks, or other entity having as its primary purpose provision of overnight accommodation, food or meals to persons who are indigent. House Bill 2131 revamps enterprise zone property tax exemption laws. House Bill 2780 includes transportation of students who attend school-sponsored after-school activities and definition of approved transportation costs for purposes of state school fund distributions. House Bill 3629 creates senior residence assessment that freezes assessed value of principal residence of senior citizens 65 years of age or older. House Bill 3770 exempts from tax income of business firm that invests in facilities in counties having highest quintile unemployment rate in state or lowest quintile median income in state if business firm meets certain employment and compensation requirements. House Bill 3733 modifies definition of energy efficient appliances for purpose of alternative energy device tax credit program to include smart energy technology devices. House Bill 3182 imposes upon elector approval of House Joint Resolution 42-2001 general retail sales tax, everyone take a deep breath, and use tax of blank percent on sale and use of tangible personal property. H.J.R. 42 proposes amendment to Oregon Constitution to prohibit personal income and corporate excise and income taxes in tax years beginning after January 1, 2003. House Bill 2074 limits tax imposed on cigars to maximum 50 cents per cigar. House Bill 2280 allows credit against personal income tax or corporate income or excise tax to be claimed for long-term care insurance premiums paid on policies first issued prior to January 1, 2000. House Bill 3280 creates personal income tax credit for contributions made to state school fund or certain school or scholarship organizations, and House Bill 3972 permits existing unexpired pollution control facility tax credits to be carried forward for up to three additional tax years if facility remains in use and operation during each additional tax year to which unused credit is carried. We are in public hearing on all of the foregoing House bills and House joint resolution. And I would then ask if anybody is here, and I think we've got somebody to speak briefly on House Bill 3640. Please.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
Mr. Yes. Chair, members Welcome. Of the committee. My name is Robin Pelton, and I work with the Mid-Willamette Valley Community Action Agency, which serves Marion and Polk counties. And I'm here to give testimony to support House Bill 3640. I'm here to speak on behalf of the shelters with which we work here in this area, and also on behalf of the low-income and homeless persons that we work with. Just to give a little bit of background on community action agencies, in case you don't have an understanding of those, community action agencies were established throughout the nation in 1964 as part of the Economic Opportunity Act, and these agencies became the cornerstone of President Johnson's war on poverty. Initially, the mission of community action agencies was to eliminate poverty. And by the early 1970s, those working in those agencies realized that it wasn't realistic to say we were going to eliminate poverty, but we did modify our vision at that point and say at least we were going to work to increase the self-sufficiency of low-income individuals. Here in our communities, the Community Action Agency has a number of different programs designed to serve low-income persons. We have the Head Start program, we have Nutrition First, we have Salem Kaiser Together, which is a drug awareness prevention program, we have Child Care Information Service, plus we have a number of family resource centers and other community resource programs that work in our two-county area. The community action agencies in the state of Oregon have been designated by the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department as lead agencies to receive funding from the state and also from the federal government to provide services to low-income persons. And the community action agency with which I work receives funding to actually contract with other providers here in our two counties. So we do contract with homeless shelters and also other social service providers that serve homeless individuals and families. Those particular contractors include the Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service, Salem Outreach Shelter, Northwest Human Services HOPE program, which is Housing Outreach and Advocacy Program, St. Joseph Shelter and Mount Angel, the YWCA, Salem Kaiser Public Schools Homeless Education Program, House of Zion and Woodburn, Salvation Army, plus the Salem Interfaith Hospitality Network. And our agency spearheads a housing and services collaborative that serves to bring housing developers and service providers together to serve homeless folks and to plan for services to meet their needs. And we bring to our community hundreds of thousands of dollars from the HUD federal government continuum of care program. One of the questions that quickly comes to mind is how many homeless persons do we have here in our two county area? And those of you who have any familiarity with this issue know that that number is very hard to get a grasp. Very difficult to clearly define because our homeless individuals and families are not easily identified. They're not visible to us here in the rural communities as, say, in New York City, where they are sleeping definitely out on the streets or they are actually housed in a great number of shelters that exist. Here in our rural communities, many of our communities don't even have a shelter to provide housing for the homeless, and in rural communities, typically homeless individuals will be staying with friends and relatives, kind of bouncing from home to home with no permanency or stability. They might be camping out, they might be living in their car, and they are very inclined to resist asking for help because they have the good Oregonian tradition of being independent and taking care of their own needs. Part of the collaborative job this year is to help define that number and put together a gaps analysis and define that. And the gaps analysis that our community put together last year about this time indicated that on any given night in Marion and Polk counties, we had 2,130 individuals who were homeless. And then in addition to that, on any given night, we had 1,221 persons in families with children who were homeless in our two-county area. Anyone of us who works on the front line, either in a shelter, as I have, or on the front line receiving calls and inquiries from those folks who are homeless, we know that definitely the number of homeless, the need is far greater than the capacity to serve. And homeless shelters are oftentimes struggling to stretch their dollar as far as they can, and in some respects, they are much like the clients that we serve. The shelters are often not adequately staffed, and many times they do not have a development director, someone who can spend full time to raise funds to do the marketing that needs to be done. And with that, oftentimes shelters are operating from 1 month to the next, wondering if they're actually going to be able to pay their staff. And I'm speaking on behalf of support of this particular bill because it is just one more effort to possibly encourage the citizens of Oregon to contribute to homeless shelters, food banks, and others that so serve our most needy Oregonians. And believing that that incentive will increase the shelter's ability to provide needed services to families, and I also believe that as each one of our citizens can make personal contact with the shelters and the programs that are operating, that they will become very impressed with what is taking place. They will actually see the face of a homeless person and realize that the homeless really are us. They are just like everyone else, as opposed to sometimes the stigma that is attached to those people, those strange, weird people that we don't understand. And that we need to understand that any one of us could become homeless if the circumstances happen in our life, that catastrophes do occur. Oftentimes what happens is that as a member of the community becomes aware of a homeless shelter and actually makes a visit of that facility, they look around and they're so impressed with what's happening that they will oftentimes say, hey, can I volunteer here? How can I get involved and become more a part of this particular operation? And that's what we believe can possibly happen. And so I would definitely like to express a support for this bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Pelz?
All right.
Thank you for coming forward. Does anybody wish to speak on House Bill 2131? How about 2780? 3629? 3770? 3733? 3182, H.J.R. 42, House Bill 2074, 2280, 3280. Hmm. Unless all want to talk on 3972 then. Anybody on 3972?
So hey. Mr. Chair,
that's the end of the train, folks. There's no more stops.
we're going to go into a work session on all these now?
Yeah.
We'll vote them en banc, to the floor. Okay, with that, then we will close the public hearings on these bills and H.J.R. 42. And Representative Williams, I won't do it, but I do have to comment. We had a very respectful moment of silence at the end of the Judiciary Committee meeting this morning for all of those bills still in the committee that did not get heard and will not be heard this session.
That's true.
Until next session.
There's always next session.
Oh, there's always got
you know
stuff.
They'll be back.
There are still relating clauses to be had.
That's right. We are out of here. I mean,